on this edition of Celebrating Science, à la Aspect, on the history of entanglement and the promise of quantum information. Brought to you by Canada's Perimeter Institute for Theoretical Physics, an independent, non-profit scientific research and education outreach organization, home to a growing cluster of international scientists who contemplate and calculate new ideas about the very essence of space, time, matter, and information. Perimeter Institute also offers a wide array of educational outreach activities for students, teachers, and members of the general public in order to share the joys of scientific research, discovery, and innovation.
Welcome to this new season of PI Public Lectures. Your participation over the years has made this one of the country's most popular forums of scientific content for general audiences, and we thank you for your ongoing interest and participation. We would also like to welcome all of the new audiences who are tuning us in electronically from around the world. They are a welcome and growing addition to the PI Public Lecture experience here in Waterloo, Ontario, Canada. Now, to welcome our guest speaker tonight, I would like to introduce Dr. Robert Myers. He is not only a faculty member and one of the Institute's founding scientists, he is also Perimeter's interim scientific director. Ladies and gentlemen, here to introduce tonight's guest speaker, Professor Rob Myers.
So tonight's lecture promises to take us into the heart of the quantum world and why quantum particles act so differently from what our intuition about the everyday world says they should. In particular, we're going to hear about entangled states, where quantum theory seems to endow subatomic particles with strange new connections or correlations that are not observed on an everyday basis. This was the source of a long-standing debate between two scientific giants, in particular Niels Bohr, one of the founders of quantum theory, and Albert Einstein, the father of relativity. It was a debate that, in fact, outlived both of those gentlemen and was only resolved decades later by the work of many other scientists, including tonight's speaker, Professor Alain Aspect, who will be speaking to us on From Einstein's Intuition to Quantum Bits. Professor Aspect.
Thank you very much. So first, let me thank Perimeter Institute for bringing me here for this fantastic opportunity to talk to a general audience, because I'm always especially pleased when physics can go out of specialized circles and have an opportunity to talk to the general public. And I would be perfectly delighted to be here if it was not for the name of the city, but if you could do something to change it to, I don't know, Lafayette or Yorktown, or I would appreciate. Thank you. Well, probably some of you know that the relationship of Einstein with quantum physics is kind of strange. We can consider Einstein as a real founder of quantum physics when in 1905 he made the hypothesis that light, radiation, is made of quanta, Lichtquanten, and these quanta that we name now photons, that is small particles which have a well-defined energy and momentum, and in case you don't know, it is for this that it got the Nobel Prize in 1922, for his insight into quantization of light. But when quantum physics was developing in the 20s, in the 1920s, Einstein was not happy at all, not about quantum physics. He was not happy about the underlying interpretation which was going on in the famous Copenhagen school. Quantum physics basically was developed around Niels Bohr and his colleagues, and they were developing not only the formalism, the mathematics for it, but they were developing an interpretation. And Einstein was extremely dissatisfied with his interpretation, and he came with many objections. Some of them were refuted by Niels Bohr, but there is one objection which Niels Bohr had a hard time refuting and which turned out to be very fruitful after 50 years, and it's a so-called Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen argument. In that year, 1935, Einstein discovered that the formalism, the mathematics of quantum mechanics, allow for a fantastic situation, which is called entanglement, and this will be the subject of our talk. And another main character in that talk will be John Bell, because this discussion between Einstein and Bohr would have been, well, basically reserved to a small circle of specialists if it was not for the great achievement of John Bell 30 years after the EPR paper. And we can say that entanglement has opened the way to a big, big, big research line, which is of which Waterloo is a world center with PI and University of Waterloo, which is called quantum information, and who knows until when we are going to have progress in quantum information. So let us start with the question that Einstein was repeatedly asking. Most of you know, and if you don't know, you are going to have an introduction to that in a few minutes, that quantum mechanics doesn't predict with certainty result, but it predicts probabilities. And Einstein was not totally happy. And he was guessing, wouldn't it be that in fact there is a more profound theory, and we only have probability because quantum mechanics is a kind of superficial theory? And in 1935, with his famous Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen paper, he thought he had demonstrated the necessity to complete quantum mechanics. And Bohr was not happy at all with his conclusion, and it is John Bell which has allowed us to settle the debate. Let us start with the Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen situation, not in the same way as it was presented by Einstein, but in the way in which modern experiments have been made, so I start directly with that scheme. Here I have a source which is emitting two photons, photon nu1 flying to the left, photon nu2 flying to the right, and they are emitted together. It's a pair of photons. And on this photon, I'm going to perform a measurement of polarization. What does it mean? Here I have a device, which is called the polarizer. And if I take a light beam, a macroscopic beam, like my green pointer here, and this light, as you know, is an electromagnetic wave, and so there is an electric field which is vibrating. And it's vibrating in a plane perpendicular to the propagation axis, which means that it may vibrate like that, or like that, or like that. And the goal of these apparatus here is to measure how it is vibrating. What is the direction of the polarization? So here you have this polarizer that you can rotate and which is making a measurement along the direction A. So I make a measurement along A, and if light is polarized along A, then it will pass and you will find it in channel plus one. But if it is polarized perpendicular to A, then it will go in the other channel, minus one. And now you ask the question, but what if the polarization is not exactly along A? For instance, let's suppose it is at 30 degrees from A. Then 75% of the beam will go in this channel, and 25% of the beam will go into that channel. Okay, fine for a big beam, like my laser beam. What if I have a single photon? Well, if I have a single photon cannot be split. You cannot have three quarters of a photon here and one quarter of a photon there. And at this point, we have quantum mechanics, which makes probabilistic prediction. It tells you the probability to get the photon here is 75%, and the probability to get the photon there is 25%. This is a probabilistic prediction of quantum mechanics. And if you want to check that in an experiment, the only thing you can do is repeat the experiment many times, do the statistics, and look at the statistics. So what you can do is make a measurement along A for the polarization of this photon, and you measure single probability. P plus of A is the probability to get plus one here when the polarizer is in orientation A. And of course, you can do a similar measurement on photonio 2. But what is much more interesting is to look at correlations. And for that, you are looking at joint probabilities. For instance, you are going to measure the joint probability P plus plus at angles A and B. And this means I put first polarizer in orientation A, second polarizer in orientation B, and I look at the probability to get plus one and plus one. And of course, I can also measure plus one, minus one, minus one, plus one, and minus one, minus one. So four joint probabilities. Okay, at this point, no EPR yet. EPR comes when I have a so-called entangled state of this form. And of course, at this point, I know I'm talking to a general audience, not to specialized physicists, and you are going to complain that I am writing equations. But hold on, when you go to a concert, you can listen to the music, even if you cannot read the notes, okay? So some of you can read the notes, and they can read the notes. If you can't, just listen to the music of my voice. Thank you. So I'm going to express with words what some of you can directly read on the equations. And that's fine. So everybody will be happy with that. I hope so, at least. So here, I'm going to explain you a little bit what is this equation. This fantastic entangled state was predicted to be possible by Einstein and his colleagues. And what does it mean? X is an axis like that. And XX means I would have a pair of photons, both of them polarized like this. Now, YY describes, in quantum mechanics, a pair of photons which are both polarized like that. Quantum mechanics allows for this. And this is a superposition of this and that. And for this, I cannot make any hand waving. I cannot tell you it's one photon like that and one like that. And the reason for that is that there is no way to transform this into a product of a given state for the first photon and a given state for the second one. This is the magic of this entangled state. This as weird, as amazing as the famous Schrödinger cat, which is both dead and alive. It's as surprising for a pair of photons to be both like this and like that. Well, Einstein recognized that the formalism of quantum mechanics allows for that state, and quantum mechanics is a very well-established theory. You have very clear rules, and if you assume that you can produce a pair of photons in that state, you can easily calculate the prediction for the probability of getting plus one, minus one, etc. And if you look first at the single probability, P plus of A and P minus of A, you find 50% chance here and 50% chance there, whatever the orientation of the first one. So it looks perfectly random. It's just like natural light coming from the sun. Same on the other side. Whatever the orientation, you get 50% chance to get plus one, 50% chance to get minus one. But hold on. What is interesting is to calculate the joint probabilities calculated by quantum mechanics starting from that entangled state. And when you work out the calculation and you take the special case where the two directions are the same, so A and B are along the same direction, then the result of the calculation is 1/2. And this is absolutely fantastic. You don't find that 1/2 is fantastic? I'm going to tell you why. It's fantastic because it tells you that there is a total correlation. Why do I say total correlation? Well, look here. Single probability to get plus one is 50%. But joint probability to get plus one and plus one is also 50%. Which means that the conditional probability to get plus one here, if I get plus one here, this conditional probability is 100%. There is total correlation between what I have here and what I have there. If you are not fully convinced, look at the other result. P plus minus is zero, which means that if I find plus one here, I'm sure to find plus one here. In other words, what I have here, random result, just like tossing a coin. There, random result, just like tossing a coin. But if I get heads here, I have heads here. If I have tails here, I have tails here. So I have random thing, but these two things are perfectly correlated. Okay, so begins to be a little more interesting, right? This is a small technical question, but I need to introduce it. In the general case, where the two orientations are not exactly the same, I want to have a quantitative measure of the correlation between both random results. And for that, there is a classical definition for a correlation of coefficient, and I don't go into details. But basically, this coefficient of correlation is the difference between of the probability to have identical result, I mean either plus plus or minus minus, minus the probability to have differing results, plus minus or minus plus. And you see, for instance, that in the previous case, when the angle was zero, probability to have same case is 1/2 and 1/2, so the sum is one, while this one is zero, and it tells you that in the case where the polarizer are aligned along the same direction, then the correlation coefficient is one. That's a full correlation. And the quantum mechanical prediction for any angle is this formula, cosine of 2 times the angle, and if the angle is zero, the cosine is one, and so you have indeed coefficient which is one. But it will be important in the rest to know that we have a quantitative prediction of quantum mechanics for that. Okay, now what about correlation? Is correlation something extraordinary? And the answer is no. There is nothing extraordinary with correlation. For instance, we are going to make a small experiment. Everybody watches very carefully the screen. At three, I'm going to do something. So watch the screen. 1, 2, 3. Now we are looking at the correlation between what happened in that side of the room, and what happened on this side of the room. What have you seen? You don't have seen anything? They were sleeping, you know? What have you seen? Green flash. What have you seen? Unbelievable. There was a strong correlation between what they have observed here and what they are there. So I have to tell you, the reason why I became a physicist is because I think that when we observe correlation in the world, we need an explanation for that. We need a rational reason for that. So quantum mechanics tells us that there is a strong correlation between the result of measurement here and the result of measurement there. And what I want is an explanation for that. So on the one hand, I have this formalism of quantum mechanics, but this is just equation, abstract mathematics. I would like to have an image for that. So let us try to make an image from the formalism of quantum mechanics, from the calculation. Well, there is two ways of making the calculation. There is a fast way, the way that the students should use if I come with a problem about this. The most efficient way to get the result immediately is a calculation which happens in a very abstract space where everything is globally described. It's efficient, but impossible to draw an image out of this calculation. And the reason why it is impossible to draw an image from this calculation, again, is that the calculation is done on the global state vector describing everything together. But there is another way to do the calculation. It's a little more complicated. It's perfectly legal. It's full orthodox quantum mechanics. For some of you who have studied quantum mechanics in the book of Claude Cohen-Tanucci and company, it's approved by Claude Cohen-Tanucci, which means absolute orthodox quantum mechanics. So what are we going to do? What I want to do is to build an image in the real world, okay? And to build the image in the real world, I'm going to separate measurement on the first side and measurement on the second side. And for that, I suppose, for instance, that this polarizer is a little closer to the source than the other one. So I make first this measurement. So what happens when I make the measurement on photon nu 1 along direction A? I already told you, whatever the orientation A, there is 50% chance to get result plus 1 and 50% chance to get the result minus 1. So plus 1 corresponds to a certain result, minus 1 corresponds to another result. And then, how do I proceed? For that, I go into the big book, the Bible of quantum mechanics, and there is a so-called postulate of the collapse of the state vector. And this postulate tells me, just after a measurement, the state vector describing the system, people who don't like equation, just listen, okay? But other one are allowed to show. The state vector describing the system is suddenly projected onto the eigenspace associated to the result that I obtain. And which means that this projection will be different according to the first result or the other result. And indeed, if I find this result, then after the measurement I get this state for describing the two photons. But if I have got that one, then I get a different state. And then I can proceed and I look at the measurement on second photon. And to look at the result of this measurement, I have just to examine this state. If first result was plus 1, then just by looking at that state, I know that if I put the second polarizer with the same orientation as the first one, then I know that I get plus 1 for the second measurement. But if I have found minus 1 here, then I get this state, then I get that, and I know immediately that I am going to get minus 1. So now I have an image for describing the correlation. Until the very last moment, I don't know if I am going to get plus 1 or minus 1. But eventually, I get one result. I have to get one result. So I get 1. If I get plus 1, immediately the other photon gets a polarization parallel to this one, and I get plus 1. But if I get minus 1, which means perpendicular to A, then I get minus 1, and immediately the other photon is orthogonal to A, and I get minus 1. That's an image. It works. It gives a description of the correlation. But for Einstein, there was a small problem. Because this reasoning remains the same whatever the distance between the two polarizers. which means that there seemed to be an instantaneous influence of the measurement here on the state of photon U2, which is far away. Can be centimeters, meters, I don't know, kilometers away. So, for Einstein, this is not acceptable, because you remember that Einstein was also the father, in the same year, 1905, of special relativity. And one of the basic foundations of relativity is that nothing can travel faster than light. And here, there is something which seems to go faster than light because it's instantaneous. Instantaneous means faster than light. At this point, we can say that nothing obliges us to develop such an image from this special way of doing the calculation. And there are plenty of correlations in the world. For instance, the one, I'm not going to repeat the experiment, but there are other correlations. For instance, twin brothers. Twin brothers have been separated just after being born. One is growing in Australia, the other one is growing in Canada. And when you come 30 years later, you discover that the eyes have the same color, and maybe they have developed the same kind of genetic disease and something like that. There are strong correlations between these two twin brothers. And of course, the explanation is that they have common chromosomes. So maybe that here we have the same thing. Maybe that here, when the two photons are prepared simultaneously in the source, they have a common property that we can name lambda. Maybe it's a polarization. They are both polarized along the same direction. And then, no surprise, you will find the correlation. And of course, there is a randomness here. OK, let's suppose that we have randomness here. It's true that some twin brothers have blue eyes, but others have black eyes, etc. So here, we have some photon polarized like that, other polarized like that, and other polarized like that. And with this, we have a scheme for understanding correlation. They are both prepared with the same property, and then each one goes away with his chromosomes. The problem with Bohr is that when you do that, you complete quantum formalism. Why do I say that you complete quantum formalism? You remember the equation describing the entangled state. It was only one equation. All the pairs are described by the same state vector. And here, I'm pretending that I have different kind of pairs. Some pairs are from the beginning polarized like that. Others are from the beginning polarized like that. So I have a supplementary parameter, lambda, which makes a discrimination between the various pairs, which means that I complete the quantum formalism and Bohr had a strong statement. You cannot complete quantum mechanics. Quantum mechanics tells you all the possible knowledge you can have about the microscopic world. So Bohr was not happy at all with this, and it was an endless debate between Einstein and Bohr. Endless, except that they both died, but I mean, they never resolved the debate. And you may be surprised to know that in spite of the fact that these were two giants, this debate did not attract much attention from a majority of physicists. It's not to say that physicists are stupid people or they do not care, but you know, something fantastic was happening in these years. Quantum mechanics was accumulating fantastic success. Quantum mechanics were allowing them to understand nature. I mean, some extraordinary facts, like, I don't go through this. Matter is stable. This is unbelievable. They told you that matter is made of charge, positive and negative. And they also tell you that positive and negative charge attract each other. How is it that matter doesn't collapse on each other? Well, you cannot understand it if you don't do quantum mechanics. So quantum mechanics allows you to understand stability of matter, chemical bond, electrical property, thermal property, mechanical properties of matters, all these wonderful and even more fantastic things like superconductivity, superfluidity, elementary particles, etc., etc., etc. And it allows you not only to understand the world, but it also allows you to invent some small things like transistor, integrated circuits, lasers, everything which is necessary to promote the society of information, okay? So when you have something like quantum mechanics, which is having so many success, you know, maybe the debate about interpretation of quantum mechanics between Bohr and Einstein is just good for retired people, okay? In addition, just to defend physicists, they were absolutely aware on the fact that Einstein was not disagreeing on the formalism. He was not disagreeing on the prediction of quantum mechanics. He believed on the prediction of quantum mechanics. He was disagreeing with Bohr on how to interpret it. Einstein wanted to introduce a sub-level and Bohr didn't want, period. That was the debate. So they did not care much. And then 1964, John Bell appears on the stage. And John Bell say, okay, let us take seriously the idea of Einstein. Let us assume that this correlation can be understood by this parameter that each photon is carrying along, and the correlation is due to the fact that it is the same set of parameters for the two photons of the same pair. So he introduces the idea that this supplementary parameter determines the result of the measurement here, so you have a function, capital A, which depends on lambda and on the orientation and can take a value plus one or minus one and gives you the result of the measurement here and another function here for giving the result of the measurement. And I told you already that there is a randomness in the preparation. Some are prepared like that, others like that, etc. So I have a density of probability for describing the statistics of the production of the lambda of the various pairs. And with that, Bell could demonstrate a fantastic theorem, which is so simple that any high school student can demonstrate it himself if he wants. And the theorem is the following. With such a formalism, which looks so simple, there is no way to reproduce all the prediction of quantum mechanics in an EPR situation. What do I mean by all? Here you have an example. This is a famous correlation coefficient I introduced a moment ago. Prediction of quantum mechanics, you remember, was a cosine of the angle between the two polarizers. That's the blue curve. And how here, I have a model, one model, the model where the two photons are emitted with the same polarization. It's the simplest model you can think about. And it is a red line. And you see it's not bad because it gives you the total correlation for the angle 0 degree. It gives minus one, which is also a total correlation for angle 90 degrees. Minus one means that when I get plus one here, I'm absolutely sure to get minus one there. So predict this, and in between, it's not very far from it. But anyway, it's not the same everywhere. And Bell's theorem is a general result telling you that what we see here is not only true for this specific hidden variable model, it's true for any model. And the demonstration is the following. Bell demonstrates that for any theory which explains the correlation by introducing the parameter lambda and the function capital A, capital B, and rho of lambda, then there is a certain quantity S which is constrained to be between minus 2 and plus 2. And this quantity S is made of four correlation of polarization. See, two orientation A and A prime for the first polarizer, two orientation B and B prime for the second polarizer. So you are going to consider four measurements, AB, AB prime, A prime B prime, A prime B. And there is no mistake here. There is three plus signs and a minus sign. Why? Well, rather ask why John Bell was a genius. He had the good idea that if you put three plus sign and a minus sign, then this quantity is constrained to be between plus 2 and minus 2. In other words, correlations that you can explain by this joint property are constrained by this inequality. On the other hand, you remember I wrote this formula that the prediction of quantum mechanics for an EPR entangled state is cosine of 2 times an angle. And if you take this special set of angle here, 22.5 degrees, and 2 times 22.5 degrees is 45, and cosine of 45 is 1 over root 2. And when you plug that into the formula, you have 1 over root 2, 1 over root 2, 1 over root 2, and here, minus 1 over root 2, but there is another minus, which makes a plus, and then the result is 4 divided by root 2, which is 2 times root 2, which is 2.8 and something, and this is obviously bigger than 2. So what do we have here? If we can explain with an image a la Einstein, the correlation S cannot be bigger than 2. But here is a prediction of quantum mechanics with a S which is bigger than 2. So this Bell theorem. There is no way to find such a theory to reproduce all the results if you take, for instance, this special set of orientation. And so now, the possibility to complete or not to complete quantum mechanics is no longer a matter of interpretation, of taste, of epistemology. It has turned into an experimental equation. Let us measure it. Let us check if it is bigger than 2 or not bigger than 2. Before embarking into the experiments, let us look again into the hypotheses that were necessary to obtain the conflict, to obtain Bell's inequality, that is to say, to obtain the conflict. Hypothesis first is we want to explain the correlation by this property lambda, by the fact that the two photon carry some property, and then the result of measurement here depends on this property, and the result of the measurement there depends on the property of the other guy. This is called local realism. Local realism means that when a certain object, a particle, a photon, is localized in a zone of space-time, then the result of all measurements that I will do on that object only depend on properties which are on that object, that local realism. To demonstrate Bell's inequality, there is a strong hypothesis which was emphasized by Bell in his initial paper, which is called Bell's locality condition. And the hypothesis is the following. You must, in this model, which is submitted to Bell's inequality and which conflicts with quantum mechanics, you must assume, to obtain Bell's inequality, that the result of the measurement here cannot depend on the orientation of the polarizer which is far away. It's reasonable, but you have to make that hypothesis. If you would not make that assumption, then you could not derive Bell's inequality. And similarly, you have to assume that the way you prepare the photons here, the way you distribute the various lambda over the various pairs, is not allowed to depend on the orientation of the apparatus which are going to make the measurement later. And of course, immediately, and Bell suggested that in his initial paper, you realize that it can be more than a hypothesis. You could imagine an experiment in which you change the orientation of each of the polarizer after the two photons have left the source. Then, obviously, if you change the orientation of this and that polarizer after the two photons leave the source, the way in which you prepare the pair cannot depend on the orientation of the polarizer later. And similarly, because you change it at the last moment, there is not enough time to send an information on the other side, and so this cannot depend on the orientation of that, otherwise it would violate relativistic causality that nothing can go faster than light. So we can say that Bell's inequality really reveals a conflict between quantum mechanics and Einstein's worldview. We have invoked Einstein several times, first to say that we must complete quantum mechanics, and second to impose this locality condition. Okay, so time to go to experiment. I am an experimentalist. So it was time to go from epistemology debates to experimental tests. And you could think that after all these wonderful successes of quantum mechanics in 64, there were plenty of experiments which have been done and which demonstrate that quantum mechanics is right, Bell's inequality is violated, etc., etc. It was not at all so. People were surprised to find out that most of the result of correlation, well, all the known result of correlation which have been measured in the world, they all obey Bell's inequality. It's very rare to have a situation when there is a conflict between quantum mechanics and Bell's inequality. And it was necessary to design specific experiments to look into this specific situation, which have never been investigated before. And I'm going to rapidly describe these various experiments. There were what I call the heroic pioneers in between 72 and 76, and there were first experiment in 72, one in Berkeley, one in Harvard, and they gave conflicting result. In Berkeley, they found quantum mechanics, and in Harvard, they did not find quantum mechanics. And believe it or not, the equation was more or less settled in Texas Agriculture and Mining University in College Station. Ed Fry did a beautiful experiment. He was the first to introduce a laser to do this measurement, and so his experiment has a better signal-to-noise ratio. Anyway, all these experiments were really, in a sense, preliminary experiments, and they were significantly different from the ideal scheme. And at about the same time, I embarked into an experiment in Institut Optique, and the first job was to develop a source of entangled photon much more efficient than the previous one, which allowed us to go for schemes closer and closer to the ideal Gedanken experiment I have described, and to test really the locality hypothesis. And then I will rapidly mention the third generation experiments that started in the mid 80s and still working now. Okay, so what was the secret for our wonderful source of entangled photon? Took me 5 years to develop it. The secret is the following. It was known, Clauser had found that in 72, that if you could excite an atom of calcium to an upper level, then this atom would emit a first photon and a second photon, and elementary calculation show that this pair of photon are going to be entangled, and you can do tests with it. The problem with Clauser when he embarked in that in 72 is that the only way to excite this level was to make an absorption of ultraviolet radiation or an excitation by electron collision towards some high-lying states here, and then the atom would decay sometime here, but most of the time to another level coming here, and then you would be producing a photon U2 but not the twin brother, and it was a terrible signal-to-noise ratio, and people had to accumulate data for days and days and days, and it's very difficult to keep an experiment running for days. When we started, there were lasers have been developing, and we found that it was possible to excite directly that state by adding two photons from two different lasers, a laser called the krypton ion laser and a tunable laser. And with a tunable laser, you can exactly excite this level. And when the atom is here, you just have to wait, and the atom can do nothing else than delivering just the pair you are expecting. And you don't have to wait a lot, because in our experiment, we could have efficiently, I mean, really catching on our detector more than 100 coincidences per second. And this is fantastic, because you just accumulate data for 100 seconds, less than 1 2-minute. Then you have 10,000 events, and the statistical accuracy goes as the root of the number of events, which means that with only 100 seconds, you have an accuracy of 1%. This was fantastic. So with this build, and there was another advantage of that source. It was small enough that with a reasonable optics, you can send the photon far away. You don't need to have huge beams, huge optics, and things like that. The result was, so this is a view of the source, but the main fact is that we could put polarizer at 6 meters of the source on one side, 6 meters from the source on the other side, and with that, we obtain a violation of Bell's inequality at a large distance. When there were discussions about entanglement, quite often people would say, look, at the scale of an atom, for instance, the two electrons that you have in a helium atom, we have entanglement, no problem. Quantum mechanics is good for small distance, for microscopic object. But when you are going to go at large distance, then this is a macroscopic world, and you are not going to observe entanglement. And if I was asking the question to a theorist, but what is a large distance for photons? He would say, coherence length of the photon. And it turns out that in that experiment, coherence length is 1.5 meters. So 6 meters is not by chance. 6 meters is bigger than the coherence length of a photon, and entanglement was still surviving. There was a clear violation of Bell's inequality at 6 meters. Okay. But the experiment was still far from the ideal. I don't want to go into details, but it was still far from the ideal Gedanken experiment scheme. And then we did our first experiment very close to the ideal scheme. We could develop real polarization splitter. When I say could develop, I could bribe a friend working for physics labs who built that for me, and I just had to pay a little bit, not too much, because otherwise I could not have them. Now I can say it, you know, after 20 years, I can say it. So I could have this wonderful device really separating the plus one channel and the minus one channel. Before that, you only add the plus one channel, not the minus one, and then you have a complicated reasoning. Now with this experiment, you really have the plus one, the minus one, and you measure simultaneously the four rate, plus plus, plus minus, and minus minus, for a given orientation set, AB. And once you have this four number, you directly extract experimentally the coefficient of correlation by just making this very simple calculation. So you take an orientation, count the four rates, and get a result. Then take another orientation, repeat, etc. And the result really struck me. Here is a quantity S submitted to Bell's inequality. The green curve is a curve which was plotted before doing the experiment. And the red points is the points we obtained the first time we did the experiment. I insist, we did not start with an experiment and then we have problem, we change thing. No, we checked everything separately and then we decided today we do the test. And this is the result of the test. What do you see? You see first, thank you. You see first, well, I wish we had obtained a different result, but that's another story. You find the points exactly on the prediction of quantum mechanics, prediction not for the ideal experiment, the prediction for the real experiment, taking into account the small inefficiency of the experiment. So it doesn't go exactly to 2.8, it goes to 2.7. And you see what is interesting, that you have to go to these special angles, like 22.5 degrees or 77.5 degrees, to be in a zone where the result of quantum mechanics violates Bell's inequality. If you do an experiment here, or if you do an experiment here, there is no conflict. And it's exactly what I was telling you. In all the experiments which had been done before Bell's inequality, people naturally look for correlation at 0 degree, 45 degree, 90 degree. Nobody was crazy enough to look at these intermediate angles, okay? So this shows that you have to go here, but here you have a violation of Bell's inequality by more than 40 error bars, which is really convincing. There is no doubt. So with this, we were really convinced that entanglement is there. Entanglement violates Bell's inequality. You cannot understand it by this lambda. But there was still this famous locality. I'm a little slow. Are you tired? Thank you. I'm a little bit, but when you say that, I survive. I'm on Paris time, you know, so. So now, the famous locality condition, the dream of John Bell, turning the polarizer while the photon were in flight. Well, this is a famous polarizer with a beam splitter here in the middle, built by Philips in Eindhoven. It was a time when companies were doing real research, you know. Sorry for that. And here you have a big mechanical assembly, something like 40 or 50 kilograms, you know. There is no equation to turn that in a few nanoseconds, okay? So it's not realistic to turn that in. You know, to travel 6 meters, it takes 20 nanoseconds. A nanosecond is 1/1,000,000th of a second, so it's fast. So you cannot turn that in less than 20 nanoseconds. So my idea was to build an optical switch which is able either to let light go here or to redirect it there. And if now I have a polarizer in orientation A prime here and A there, and a switch going fast from one to the other one, this is obviously equivalent to a single polarizer rotating from A to A prime and back. And of course, do the same thing on the other side. And I could build switches able to switch every 10 nanoseconds. And again, it takes 20 nanoseconds from here to there. So this switching was really happening during the time of flight of the photons. It was a difficult experiment because the switches obliged us to reduce the aperture, so there was less signal. We had to accumulate data, not for days, but at least for several hours, which is not so easy. In addition, the switches were not fully random. There was some periodicity here, a periodicity there. So the experiment is not truly ideal. Anyway, it was the first experiment where somebody try to test Bell's inequality in changing the orientation of the measurement while the particles are in flight. And we got a convincing result. We got a violation of Bell's inequality by 6 error bars. And for the first time, each measurement was really separated from the setting of the distant polarizer by a space-like separation. Space-like separation means, in the jargon of relativity, that there is no possibility that the signal travels from one event to the other one except by traveling faster than light. Okay, so we had a test, we had enforced Einstein causality, and anyway, Bell's inequality are violated, which means you have to renounce. There have been a lot of improvements in the 80s because people could design even better source of entangled photons. The idea is to use a nonlinear crystal to produce twin entangled photons, and the real improvement is the following. In my source, photons were emitted in all directions, which means you need big lenses to catch them, or lenses to catch them, and then you have macroscopic beams. Here, with this nonlinear device, you can produce the pair of photons in well-defined direction so that you can feed them into optical fibers. And then once they are in the optical fibers, you can pull the measurement far away. For instance, Nicolas Gisin in Geneva could convince Swiss Telecom to lend him the network of Swiss Telecom at night. You know, Swiss are very quiet people. At night, they sleep. And meanwhile, Nicolas Gisin is doing his measurement, okay? And with that, he could do a measurement with the station distance for more than 10 kilometers. And he found a violation of Bell's inequality, and So entanglement survives more than 20 kilometers. Now, in 98, in Innsbruck, there was another experiment, which is the ultimate experiment in that kind. It was the experiment I was dreaming to do. It was done in the lab of Anton Zeilinger and Gregor Weiss, which is now at the University of Waterloo, was doing that experiment for his PhD thesis. So they feed the two photons into optical fibers, which are hundreds of meters long, and it's long enough that they have the time, during the time of flight of the photon, to run a random generator, random number generator, to choose at random the orientation of the polarizer. I told you, my switches were going as fast as I could here and there, but you know, it was periodic. Here, they really have the time to run a random generator and choose at random the orientation, and then they accumulate the data. When everything is finished, they look at the correlation, and they found a clear violation of quantum mechanics. By the way, it's the first time the experiment I had been doing in 82 was repeated. So this experiment has been done two times, one in 82 and one in Innsbruck in 98. I can tell you, I was a little nervous when they were doing the experiment to know the result. You never know, you know. I was very glad they found agreement with quantum mechanics, same thing that I have found some time earlier. Okay, so we can say, safely, of course, not everybody agrees, but I think it's only a minority of people who still argue that we could do a little better. We can say basically that we have demonstrated the violation of Bell's inequality, so local realism, as it was suggested by Einstein, has to be rejected. We cannot accept it. And what does it mean? Well, we just have to read Einstein. Einstein wrote about what happens if you don't have local realism. Not that Einstein did not believe in what he was saying, but he was making the reasoning ad absurdum, saying, if I was right, this would be the catastrophe that would happen. But now it has happened, so we better read what he was saying. And he was saying that you have either, to be frank, I don't understand the either or. For me, it's almost equivalent. But let's read Einstein. Either drop the need of the independence of the physical reality present in different parts of space, or accept that the measurement on one side changes instantaneously, it's written by Einstein himself, the real situation on the other side. This is what some people called quantum non-locality. We have to abandon the idea that when the two photons are separated by 10 meters or 10 kilometers, we have to abandon the idea that I have here an object, and these objects are well separated in the sense that if I do something here, it will take some time to affect the other way, the other one which is far away. We have to accept that if I do something here, it changes instantaneously something there. Some people call that non-locality. Other people call it quantum holism, to say that the two photons remain a whole, a single object, even if they are separated by 20 kilometers. Now, a warning. Even if there is a quantum non-locality, even if we are sure now that when we do something here, apparently it affects somewhere else, you cannot use it to transmit a signal faster than light for a practical purpose. And if you ask me the question, I will be glad to explain you why. But now, it's time to go to the last part of my talk. It will be another hour, I think. This subject of testing Bell's inequality and demonstrating that entanglement is as extraordinary as it is was really a basic question of interpretation, question of a debate between Einstein and Bohr. But then, big surprise, people discovered that entanglement is so fantastic that it can be good for something. And they began to think on the basic principles of computing, of information theory. And you have dogma like all computers are the same, they are all equivalent. Well, they are equivalent if they are based on the same physical property. But now if you come with entanglement, which is completely different from the usual property, maybe you can you could develop computers with totally different properties. And this is called quantum information. So in fact, quantum information is done of two different things, quantum computers and quantum cryptography with two different schemes, Bennett Brasser and the Eckert scheme. And entanglement is at the root of several schemes. I don't say all the schemes, but several schemes for quantum information. And I'm going to review rapidly these schemes. Let us start with the simplest thing to explain after the previous talk, which is how it is possible to send a secret key or to share a secret key between two friends, Alice and Bob, that you have here, in spite of the awful eavesdropper who is trying to get an extra copy. And the problem is the following. There is a theorem demonstrated by Robert Shannon long ago, which is the following. If two people have two identical copies of a random series of plus one and minus one of numbers, they can use it to encode and decode a message, and there will be an absolute confidentiality and absolute secrecy, provided that they use it only once for a message which is not longer than the key. So you have the two friends, they have two identical copies, and she sends a message and say, "I miss you." And he receives a message, he's happy, but now they have used the key. They need to have a new key. And maybe they cannot travel if they could travel and meet each other, they would not need to have this this scheme. So they are far away. And now the problem is to give them a new key. That is to say, the same random series of number that they will use only once. And Eve is trying to get a copy while we are sending copy. And the solution found with entangled photon is the following. You take this source of entangled photon, and you send photon U1 to the left, photon U2 to the right, and Alice and Bob are going to move their polarizer, but they decide in advance that sometimes they have the same orientation, AA, sometimes the same orientation, A prime, but sometimes it's not the same, okay? And once it is finished, they will exchange by public radio the list of the orientation they have chosen, and so they know exactly when the orientation were the same. So now we consider only the situation when the orientation here and the orientation there are the same. And you remember what I explained to you? Here, photon arrives, we don't know if we are going to get plus one or minus one. But if we get plus one here, we are sure to get plus one here, and if we get minus one here, we are sure to get minus one here. So indeed, it's a list of random numbers, and they are the same, so I have two identical copies of the key. And now, why is it that Eve cannot make a copy of it? Because there is nothing to spy. There is no hidden variable. There is no lambda. If there was a lambda, he could watch the lambda and make a note of it, but there is no lambda. There is violation of Bell's inequality, which means the lambda do not exist, the plus one or minus one do not exist before the measurement. And you can refine the reasoning, and you can demonstrate that if Eve is so smart, then he would make a measurement, make a note of it, and re-emit a photon with the same, exactly the same value as the one he has measured, then it would be easy for Alice and Bob to see that there is somebody doing that, how would they see it? They just make a test of Bell's inequality. If there is a guy here making a measurement, then he makes something like a lambda. There is something like a supplementary parameter, and as soon as there is somebody observing here, it will no longer violate Bell's inequality. So they make a test of Bell's inequality. If they violate Bell's inequality, they know that there is no Eve on the line. So you see now what is a big improvement of quantum cryptography compared to classical cryptography. In classical cryptography, you make the assumption that your enemy has about the same level of development as yours. It doesn't have computer 1 billion times more powerful than yours, or it doesn't have a genius in mathematics who have found a way of factorizing big numbers. But you don't know. Maybe there is a more advanced enemy somewhere who doesn't publish his results. He doesn't say that he has a more powerful computer. He doesn't say that he has a wonderful mathematical theorem for factorizing number. Here, the safety of the scheme relies on the very laws of quantum mechanics. Of course, you can say maybe somebody knows that quantum mechanics is not true and is using the bridge, but we don't know yet. We have not found any failure of quantum mechanics. So quantum cryptography is working. What about quantum computing? Quantum computing, nobody knows if it will work someday as a practical computer. The idea is the following. The idea is massive parallelism. And in a nutshell, this is a basic idea. Polarization of a photon is what we call a qubit, a quantum bit. It's a quantity which can be either in one state or in another state or in any superposition of the two states. It's described in a space of dimension 2. The basis is plus or minus. Now, when I have two quantum bits, entanglement and entangled state must be described in a space of dimension 4, because I can have plus plus, plus minus minus, and minus plus. If I have three qubits, the space has a dimension 8, like 2 to the cube. If I have 10 qubits entangled, the space where I describe things has a dimension 2 to the 10, which is 1,000. If I have 20 qubits, dimension of the space is 1 million. I stop at this point. It means that if I could have 20 entangled qubits, make an entangled state, and make a global operation on that state, and if that global operation was something like a quantum calculation, I would simultaneously make 1 million operations simultaneously. And if it was 30 qubits, it would be 1 billion. So the idea of quantum computing is massive parallelism. Nobody knows if it will work, because the world record at the moment is 8 entangled qubits, and it's very difficult to get many, many entangled qubits. So we don't know, but we can ask a question. Are we already living in a new quantum age, or are we going to live in a new quantum age? I think really that what I have described here really opens a new quantum revolution, because entanglement is really something revolutionary, which is completely different from the concepts underlying the first quantum revolution. I told you quantum mechanics was developed in 20, and it was developed basically, to make it a little too simple, it was based on wave-particle duality. Now we have something which is completely different, which is entanglement. Entanglement is a new concept, and we had to wait until Bell to realize that it is really a new concept. And there is something which is very important, I think, for this second quantum revolution. And this also happened starting in 1980. Physicists learn how to manipulate single individual objects. For instance, here you have this famous picture where people with the scanning tunneling microscope can move individual atoms and arrange them here, and you have individual atoms here, and you can see at the density, etc. Here we have source of single photon. We know nowadays how to produce easily single photons, and this is used for one of the famous cryptography scheme, another one, the Bennett and Brasa scheme. Here we have a single electron or a single ion which is trapped here, and when I have a single ion which is trapped here, I can directly observe with almost a naked eye the famous quantum jumps, etc., etc. This is another ingredient which is very important, and I'm personally convinced that the ensemble of entanglement plus manipulation of single objects really opens a totally new quantum age. So at this point, we can ask the question. First quantum revolution was first conceptual, but it gave us laser, transistor, integrated circuit. Okay, so will the new quantum revolution give birth to a new technological revolution based on quantum communication and quantum computers? Well, I already told you, we don't know. I think that the roadmap, as usual, will start from proofs of principle, which is done with elementary, natural, microscopic objects like atoms, ions, photons, molecules. But of course, the real challenge is to build it with solid-state devices. And if we can do that with solid-state devices, it means you can scale it to a bigger and larger number of entangled qubits, etc. And we don't know. It is a fascinating issue, and we live exciting times. And with this, I'm going to thank you for your attention.
Concerning locality and in the entanglement of the Alice and Bob particles, I thought of time's arrow. I know for sure time's arrow is applicable to the particle aspect of the photon, but is there some possibility that time's arrow is not applicable to the wave aspect of photon? In other words, things like polarity. So then locality becomes a non-issue. Thank you.
Well, I'm sorry because I did not completely understood the question, but as far as I understand, your question is how much is the reasoning depending on the fact that I describe a photon as a particle, and you seem to suggest that if I would describe it as a wave, there would be no problem? And the answer is no. There would still be exactly the same problem if I make a model where I have a small classical wave packet. I have a small antenna emitting a short pulse. Okay, then this will have to obey Bell's inequality, and the fact any classical model, either particle described by classical mechanics and classical equation, all classical wave has to obey Bell's inequality. A proof for people who know something about electrodynamics, for instance, any classical field depends on the charges and currents in the source. So in fact, if I assume that the lambda of Bell's formalism is the currents and the charge position in the source, then the fields depend on lambda, and it is easy to show that any classical wave, any classical electromagnetic field has to obey Bell's inequality. So the fact that we observe a violation of Bell's inequality means that there is no classical picture to describe it, either particle or wave. If it is a wave, it has to be a quantum wave.
Okay, I think we have a question over here.
I'm Leif Baker. My question is, you used the word instantaneously, that you said that Einstein had written it down that way. Does that mean zero time has elapsed, or is it a small bit of time that has elapsed between when you use the word instantaneously?
Well, unfortunately, the word instantaneously, as soon as you use it, you have to face big problems. Because, as we know from Einstein relativity, instantaneous means, in fact, space-like separated, which means that according to special relativity, the two events happen at time and position such that if a signal has to go from one to the other one, it has to go faster than light. And in such a situation, it means that by changing frame of reference, one could be simultaneous to the other one, or one could be before the other one, or it could be the reverse. So the only way to give a sense, well, the only way we know to give a sense to the word instantaneous is to accept that there is a preferred frame of reference, and it raises other problems. But yes, the point is that the formalism of quantum mechanics gives you a result where there is no problem. You crunch the equations, you find the result, you do an experiment, the experiment supports the prediction of quantum mechanics. The problem comes when you start to make images. So you, in my images, I have to admit that there is something instantaneous. But on the other hand, I am aware that this image is questionable. So you could tell me, don't make any image. Fine. There are some people who can make progress without any image. But there are some people like me who need images to support their imagination and to be creative, to think about new situations. So in quantum mechanics, there is not only entanglement. There is also wave-particle duality. And by the way, if you want to invite me again, I have another lecture about wave-particle duality with a single photon. Wave-particle duality for a single photon also has problem with the image. Sometimes I take the point of view that it is a particle, sometimes the point of view that it is a wave. The image is inconsistent, but I am experienced enough that I can use these inconsistent images to have imagination and to think about new and exciting situations, and then to be on safe ground, the only thing I know is to write the mathematics and go to the end of the calculation. And sometimes the calculation supports my intuition, and sometimes it does not, so I have to be careful with that. So the only thing I can tell you is that because I like images, I have to admit that these images are slightly inconsistent, but I can live with it.
My question is about your experiment when you're describing it in 1982. You said that you wished that you did not get the results that fit exactly the curve of the Bell inequality. What did you wish you had?
Well, wish is an exaggeration. I say that now, from my perspective, well, if I had not found a result in agreement with quantum mechanics, and if this result had been confirmed by other experiments, it would have meant that we have found one of the limits of quantum mechanics. And this would be fantastic, because we are all deeply convinced that one day we will find the situation where quantum mechanics stops working. That's the natural evolution of all physical theory. Classical mechanics is good for classical motion, but when the velocity comes close to the velocity of light, classical mechanics is no longer good. So you always look for the frontiers of your theory. We know that quantum mechanics is good for many, many, many things, But we hope that someday we find one of the corners where quantum mechanics stops being true. If I had found the result not in agreement with quantum mechanics, I would have discovered one of these places. Nobody has yet discovered any place where quantum mechanics fails, but all reasonable physicists think that someday we are going to find a place where quantum mechanics fails. We don't know where.
So we will end on that note, and I'd like to confirm that we will definitely have you back in the years ahead. We've very much appreciated the talk, and I'd like to thank you one more time.
Thank you.